Hello, and welcome to episode 149 of Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
In this episode, we will ask ourselves, do we like campus novels? And in the second half, two lesser discussed novels by Muriel Spark, The Bachelors and Symposium. Mm. And well, before we get to that, I want to know what you're reading, of course, Rachel, but also you've got some exciting news to share.
Oh, yes. Well, I've got my first full-length play is being staged in London next week. If you'd like to come, you'd be very welcome. It's on at a theatre called the Drayton Arms in South Kensington, and the play is called Night Shift. Simon, I'm sure you'll put a link on there.
Yeah. And so what dates is that for anyone out of this?
So it's the Tuesday the 21st to Saturday the 25th of April. So it's next week.
Very exciting. If you come on Saturday night, I will be in the audience. Do let us know if you're coming. We'd love to say hello to you, I'm sure.
Yeah. And I mean, obviously, the main reason for coming would be to meet you on Saturday night.
Of course. Well, when I went to book my ticket, I did spot that one of the characters was called Simon. I presume an homage to me.
He's not a great character, so no, an homage to you. Oh, no, Ashti. He's got his positive points, but no, nothing like you, don't worry.
Okay. I mean, he's got his positive points, I'll take. But it's so exciting. What an amazing thing. I can't wait to go and see it.
Yeah, I'm excited. Well, I'm excited and nervous. They've started rehearsing this week, today, so it's going well so far, apparently. I'm not involved in the rehearsals. I've got a director, so I'm staying well out of it because nobody wants the writer sticking out at this point. So
So that's Night Shift. I'll put a link in the notes, which you can find at stuckinabook.com. And I think you can also find wherever you're listening to this podcast, it should be in the episode description. So and what you're reading?
Well, I've been reading a lot, actually, because it's just been Easter holidays for me. And as you know, I tend to read a lot when I'm not at school. And I was on holiday in Lanzarote for a week where there's not much to do other than, I mean, there were amazing volcanoes that we visited, but otherwise just lying around. It was my dad's, well, actually it's tomorrow, my dad's turned 70, very exciting. So it was a big family holiday to celebrate daddy. And we did lots of lounging around and I did lots of reading. So I obviously read The Sparks for the podcast, which I won't mention because we'll talk about those in a minute. And I tried to catch up with some of the contemporary stuff that was on the pile in my kitchen of books I keep meaning to read. And by the time I get around to reading them, they no longer really are contemporary. But I read The Marriage Portrait by Maggie O'Farrell. Which is a kind of lightly fictionalized version of the story of Lucrezia de Medici and her marriage in the Renaissance period. Yeah, I mean, I'm not great on Italian history.
Oh, I have no idea. No.
And also based on the famous poem My Last Duchess by Robert Browning. That's the story in the poem about this famed marriage portrait that was made of Lucrezia, who was then died in suspicious circumstances less than a year after she married this horrific man who went on to marry two more women after her. So both of whom also, I think, died in suspicious circumstances. Ooh. But hey, it's the Renaissance and there's no punishment for that kind of behaviour. So I really enjoyed Hamnet by Maggie O'Farrell, which I'm sure lots of people, if they haven't read the book, they'd have heard of through the recent film, which won all the Oscars and was very good. So I found it really good, actually. It was a really interesting read for me because it was kind of historical fiction, but it wears the history lightly. You know, it's not like Hilary Mantle where it's super detailed. I think you would have liked it, actually, because as much as you don't love historical novels, it didn't feel like a historical novel. It felt more contemporary. And I enjoyed its focus on women's lives and misogyny. You know, all these things interest me. I'd recommend it. It was a good holiday read. I wouldn't say that it's like, you know, high literature or anything, but it was, an enjoyable read. And I'm still working my way through my Vera Brittain book. Great, that I mentioned last time. It's 600 pages. I'm now at the 400 page point, which feels like a real achievement, but it also feels like it should have ended by now, but still. But I am enjoying it, actually. It's one of those books that, you know, you think, I'll never read this again, but that doesn't mean that I haven't enjoyed the process.
Yeah.
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 So, yeah, that's what I've been reading.
Nice. Yeah, I do really like Maggie O'Farrell. I've read quite a few, and I did love Hamnet. It, as you say, it doesn't feel very, it is a historical novel, like, or sort of a speculative one at times as well, but it doesn't feel very heavy-handed and look at me, I've done all my research in the way that I'm sometimes put off. And yeah. For some reason, I wasn't as keen to go to The Marriage Portrait, I guess because I didn't know anything about the Medicis, whereas I know a fair amount about Shakespeare, so it felt like I'd be more at sea. But yeah, I often take Maggie O'Farrell on holiday.
I don't think you need to know anything about the period in order to enjoy it, because she gives you all the information you need to know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And have you been to Florence?
I did a day in Florence once. So I stayed in Siena and we did like a day trip. So
you know, you'll recognise the setting. Yeah. So you should give it a go.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of hers I've not read. What have I got? But I think my favourite of hers that I've read so far is maybe Instructions for a Heatwave. I really loved. That was fun.
Okay. Yeah, I've only read Hamnet in this, so I need to go to the backlist.
Yeah, her autobiography, I Am, I Am, I Am, about all the times that she's almost died, is extraordinary. So that's okay. It's quite bleak at times, but it's very good. Well, I am reading, inspired by an episode we did not that long ago, another Bernice Rubens novel.
Wow.
Yesterday in the Back Lane, it's called, which turns out it's got one of those tropes that is so common that I really don't like, which is an old person saying in the first paragraphs or first opening, we're like, oh, I'm thinking about my youth, and then the rest of the novel is in the past. And I think, why have you done this? But just tell the novel in the past. And it's about, yeah, this, she's old now, but in the main part of the novel, I think she's 17, and she is walking home one day, in walking down the back lane to get in, you know, into the back garden, and a man stops and tries to rape her, and she murders him. And then the rest of the novel is like, what happens after that? So, yeah. It's very different from the 5-year sentence? Was that what it was called?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Which was quite surreal and spiky and strange in really fun ways. This is much more straightforward narratively. And I would not really have pegged it as the same writer, to be honest. But I think it's also very good. So it's interesting that she clearly has quite different styles depending on what sort of book she's writing.
So this one doesn't have that same sort of darkness to it.
I mean, it's dark in a way, but not in a sort of like, not in that almost like malicious, humorous, dark humor sort of vibe that the 5-year sentence had. This is much more, it's dark because something, you know, because there are scary people out there, but the actual style is quite, in some ways, quite bright and optimistic, actually, for considering what's going on. And there are funny things. There's particularly funny. There's one of the women on the street who runs effectively a brothel, but also is the only person who's got a basement. And because it's set during the Second World War, people still go and shelter there from bombs, but don't want to know her socially. And the dynamics of that are dealt with quite amusingly. So that's quite fun.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, I'll give it a go. I actually saw a whole batch of her books the other day in a secondhand bookshop. And I was like, isn't it funny that you can go your whole life not noticing or seeing other people on one, and then suddenly they're everywhere?
I think I've got about 6 or 7 now, because I thought, oh, I must buy them up. And yeah, but I think actually they're quite easy to get hold of. I was a bit blind to them.
Yeah.
And I'm also reading the second of the On the Calculation of Volume books.
Oh, yes.
Sylvia Bader.
Well, I've decided I'm going to read them in the summer because I shall be in Scandinavia. So I'll
perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's excellent as the first one, but it's much more sort of melancholy. The first one was about, it felt quite optimistic about her finding space in this time loop, and this one's more about feeling very claustrophobic in it and trying to, a lot of so far is her trying to find different seasons. She's like, I'm sick of winter, basically. So she's trying to cross the world to somewhere where it's spring. But it is, I think there's 3 out in English now, so hopefully they'll translate some more soon.
I think there's actually more than that. I think I saw a fourth one in the bookshop the other day.
Ooh, is the fourth one being translated? Because I know there's six out in Danish, but I don't know how many have been translated, but maybe the fourth one's out.
Yeah, I think the fourth one just came out.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Before we get onto the topic, just going to mention, this is, as I mentioned, episode 149, and for episode 150, we'll be doing a Q&A episode, so we do need some questions. Thanks so much for the ones we've had in so far, but we'd love to have more. It can be about books or the podcast or anything you like. So teaorbooks@gmail.com, send them in and we will almost certainly answer them in the next episode.
Yeah, wonderful. Looking forward to it. Can't believe it's been 150
episodes. 150
episodes.
It's Lord. Wild. And yeah, on to our first topic, which is suggested by Lisa. I'm just going to read a bit from her email. She says, "Hi, Simon and Rachel. I just finished reading Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety after hearing Rachel recommended his books and realized that I seem to have read several good books by American writers set in or around universities, campus novels, I guess you call them. I've probably read as many set in English universities." She gives a whole bunch of examples, but I'm not going to say them yet in case we need to go back to them. Yeah, so she wants to know basically what we thought of the campus novel. Do we like them? Why is it such a popular setting? All that sort of thing. What comes to mind first, Rachel?
Well, I think for me, the most iconic campus novel is Donna Tartt's The Secret History, and it's one of my absolute favourite books. And I think it works so well as a campus novel because you have that kind of closed environment of a world of shared values. Everyone's the same age. Everyone's going through the same phase of life together. It's a very intense environment where you form those very intense friendships, where you've got this complete independence for the first time. You've been taken out of your home environment where you've spent your entire childhood. There's nobody who knows you, and you can become whoever you want to be. And that's very much at the heart of this story, particularly the protagonist. I think his name's Richard. I've read that book so many times, but you know, I just have no memory. And him wanting to transform and become a part of this group of people, and that propelling him to do terrible things that are completely out of character. So yeah, I think that for me was my the most memorable campus novel I've read, in terms of it being about that transformational effect of going to university and how you can become a different person. But I think there's also another genre of campus novels that's much more about the experience of being an academic. Like this one's about students. And I think Stoner by John Williams was very, very famous several years ago now, wasn't it, when it got republished or rediscovered or something.
Yeah.
And that is a really powerful novel about a man who's, you know, been in the same institution pretty much his whole life, and that feeling of regret and stagnation that you can get in that environment of, you know, seeing the students moving on and you're remaining there and becoming outdated as well. You know, like the theory has moved on, the fashion has moved on in terms of the way people think about things, and you're still stuck in the past. I found that really interesting and really moving.
Yeah, I was similarly thinking about the difference between campus novels that are about the students and those that are about the faculty. And I couldn't really think of many I'd read that were primarily about the students, except for The Secret History, which obviously is. And I seem to be much more drawn to the ones that were about the faculty. And I thought, yeah, I also wrote down Stoner, which is fascinating. I guess Stoner, there is, you know, some interaction between the two. And similarly, Shirley Jackson's, is it Hangzaman, I think, has students' experience and faculty experience overlap. The Sandcastle by Iris Murdoch's another one where it's almost, in quite a lot of these, it's like the student body is some sort of threat, or they're the things that change when the faculty stay the same, and that is either threatening, or sometimes it's like the temptation. There's a lot of, seems to be a lot of affairs between female students and male faculty in these novels, and it is that sense of both stasis and constant change when you are doing the same job in the same place for a long time, but the people around you are always shifting with new ideas and new generations and all that sort of thing. Yeah. And one of my favorites in this genre actually is The Small Room by Mae Sarton, which is a really simple novel and not her most famous one, but I think it's a university rather than a high school, but it's about a teacher who catches this very promising student cheating on a test, and it becomes this big like political thing about whether or not she shops her, essentially, or like, you know, expels her, or I can't remember exactly the punishment, but it seems like this very straightforward case of she cheated, therefore she can't get her degree, or her can't get whatever precisely it is in that book. But it becomes this ethical moral maze for other members of the teaching staff who have their reasons for wanting her to do well. And it's one of those things like that Trollope often does. It takes this quite small scale moral issue and really like delves into it in a way that I find really fascinating. So that's the sort of thing that could be replicated any number of times on a campus, where it feels to those involved like it is the whole world. I guess that's the thing. They are so microcosmic, is that the word, of the world, because whilst you're there, particularly as a student, but also when you're working there, it feels like it is the whole world, and everything plays out much larger than it might if you are not in this arena with the same people day in, day out.
Yeah, and I think that is what makes them so compelling to read. And I think as well that for many of us who might read that type of literature will have been at university ourselves, and I think it's quite interesting to view it from the perspective of the staff and the faculty, as opposed to the students. But I think I enjoy the more sort of satirical novels as well, looking at the life of an academic, and like David Lodge is so brilliant in his faculty novels. I think British Museum is Falling Down is my favourite, of like the rivalry and the kind of childish behaviour that can go on behind the scenes to try and get one over on a fellow academic, or to, you know, publish your research before someone else, or to, you know, get yourself in the dean or whatever, or to be seen as being trendy with the students, that kind of thing. I find his send up of also the kind of ridiculous topics of interest that some people have in universities, or how ridiculously niche you have to become in order to get something published. All of that is quite good. And even though he was writing, I think, in the sort of 70s and 80s, wasn't he? It still feels very relevant, which I suppose says something itself for how much the world of academia moves on. But
I've only read Nice Work and I hated it, I'm going to be honest with it. I'm sorry to say, largely because of how obsessed he was with writing about people going to the toilet. It was constant in Nice Work. And it's like, why, David? Why have you done this so much?
I've not read that one, but the British Museum is Falling Down is hilarious. And I think it's another one, actually, thinking about academia, but from a completely different perspective, is Possession by A.S. Byatt.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
Which is based on a discovery, for people who haven't read it, of an academic who is doing just that. He's been forced into studying this really obscure Victorian poet because he needs to get something published. And he finds, and nobody's looked at this bloke in years, and he goes into the archives and finds within this box of stuff that no one's looked at in 100 years, this cache of secret letters between this poet and another Victorian poet who's assumed to have been a lesbian, and in fact they were having this torrid affair, and that's the sort of the basis of the story. I mean, it's not a campus novel in the sense that it's all about that, because obviously you go back in time and you see the story of the Victorian poets happening, but I think the premise that of what academia can offer in terms of a sort of adventure, and obviously there's lots of conferences and sex between professors and things like that. So that's a kind of interesting version of the genre.
Yeah, I think it's also a genre that has one of the most boring books I've ever read. I don't know if you've read any C.P. Snow, but I read The Masters, or The Master, which is essentially about the election of a new master of a college, which, you know, could have been very interesting, but my goodness, it was tedious. And it's in this endless series of novels. He was married to Pamela Hansford Johnson, who I think is an excellent writer, and I know you've also loved Catherine Carter, and I thought Pamela, why didn't you give him some tips? But I think when I reviewed that one very scathingly, I did get some outraged comments on it because he's meant to be brilliant, but my gosh, it was dull. Whereas suppose on the other hand, one of the most, it's like whatever the opposite of dull is, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, set between, obviously a play, but by Edward Albee, but that's got two academics and their wives, one older and established, one younger, and we saw it together years ago.
Which
is lovely, but it was totally exhausting just watching it. Like, they basically descends into them screaming at each other, and it's like, how are they doing this 6 days a week, whatever it was? It was so emotionally, like, I felt wrung out just being near it, but brilliant. It's brilliant play.
Staunton in it when we saw it.
It was, yeah, Meredith Staunton, yeah. He was so good in it.
Yeah. Yes, that's an interesting one. And there are several plays set in kind of educational environments that are interesting. I mean, The History Boys is not university, but I mean, the boys have actually left school by the point they're coming back for an extra bit of help with the university applications. And that's a really interesting one, looking at the complex relationship between teachers and pupils. And I think, you know, the real classic of that genre, if we're going to sort of secondary school rather than university, is The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie, which by Muriel Spark, who we will be talking about later on, which again is really interesting on the manipulative power of teachers, which is something that's also kind of really interesting to think about in terms of the secret history, thinking about how much does Julian, the professor of these students, bear responsibility for what happens in the way that he kind of forms their thinking.
Yeah, I think for many years I didn't read campus novels, or at least I was put off them because I was a student for so long. So I think I was a full-time student until I was 27, 28, and it was just like a busman's holiday, really. Or even worse, like, I was quite often feeling quite stressed about university, and I thought the last thing I want when I'm trying to relax with a novel is to be reminded of the stuff I have not done, or the conferences I should be going to, or whatever. But now it's all a lot far behind me. It is quite, let's say, call it a unique setup. It is, with unique opportunities for demonstrating power imbalances and clashes of generational ideas. And I don't think I've read any that are more contemporary than The Secret History that I can think of. I'm sure there are plenty being written now about increasing disparity between the generation's views on any number of things. And there's probably some very terrible satires about safe spaces or et cetera, et cetera. But I think it's also a time, obviously, when young people are adults for the first time, exploring ideas, meeting people from different walks of life in a way they haven't before. And that clash with people who, again, like, are in the same job for year after year is really fascinating. I think the sort of broader thing of, like, David Lodge style mocking people's type of academia, and Tom Stoppard does the same. It's fun, but it's also quite low hanging fruit. It's very easy to mock. And yeah, I get it. As someone who did an incredibly niche, useless PhD, I understand. But
Simon.
Very kind. But yeah, I think I prefer the ones which are a bit more inquisitive about what that experience is. Seasoned Timber is another one, actually, that we did on here years ago. Dorothy Canfield Fisher. Because it is such a unusual stage of life, particularly for the student who is going to go off to a completely different part of life later on, and capturing what makes that period so unusual and so formative, I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, and I think I'm interested in contemporary novels that deal with the politics these days that goes on in universities, and the fact that certainly now, more so than at the time when David Lodge was writing, is that very much the student, it has the power, and in terms of being the person bringing the money into the universities. You know, back in David Lodge's days, students didn't pay to go to university, so certainly not in the UK anyway. Yeah. So it's a very different environment. And I just watched, actually, the series Vladimir on Netflix. It's all about this, that is from a novel that I've not read. I don't know the name of the writer, but it must be been written in the last 3 years or so. It's pretty steamy stuff. I did enjoy it, but the central premise is about a woman who is a university lecturer of English, whose husband, who's also a lecturer of English, has been accused of inappropriate behaviour with numerous female students over the years. And the argument that they're making is that, well, that was normal back then. You know, why these women are adults, they're old enough to make choices, like they're at university, why can't we have these relationships? And the younger staff having a very different perspective and looking at that generational change within the actual faculty themselves, but also the way that then the students get involved and the pressure that the students then put on for there to be punishment for people to have to give up their jobs and things like that. So I found that very interesting.
Yeah, I only watched the first episode, but I must go back to it. I think I was slightly lost at the idea that the main character is beginning to feel like neglected and unlovely, and it's played by Rachel Weisz. It's like, come on. Come on. Most beautiful women ever.
I feel like so irrelevant and no one looks at me anymore. It's like, yeah, right, okay.
Sure. Yeah, are we sure?
More disturbing for me is that the guy who plays the younger love interest is pretty much the double for my oldest nephew. So,
oh no.
Everyone keeps saying to him that, like, oh my god, you really look like that guy, and I'm like, I know he does,
but that's a different part of Auntie Rachel's mind, so let's not
I can't go there, so can't go to bed there to the fact I've got a nephew who's nearly 20, but there we go.
Gracious.
I know.
Well, should we do our Tealbooks decision, a yay or nay on campus novels?
Yeah, I think I find them really interesting, and I mean, it depends. I think I find it more interesting to read about the experience of the faculty than the students myself. But I'm always happy to read books set in that environment. As a teacher, I find it fascinating.
Yeah, there would definitely have been a time when I would say absolutely not, but now I'm yes, and like you, more interested, I think, in the faculty than the students, but I like it when they overlap as well. So yeah, any suggestions, do let us know, tealbooks@gmail.com. We'd love to hear more. Yeah. And we do have a question for the middle that does sort of link, actually, from Amanda. She said, could you suggest a few of your personal favourite books about the literary scene, people who work in the book world? And she says that she's really enjoying one called The English Understand Wool by Helen DeWitt, which I did read last year, 2 years ago, and I don't remember a single thing about, but I know people love it. So maybe I thought if we could just do maybe like two or three each, but obviously I've had more time to think about it, so I can do mine if you want a moment to
I might need a moment, yeah, if you go ahead.
And I've tried to do I've tried not to do bookshops because we've done those before, so these are other literary scene people. So one is you do what you like, but that's what I'm going with. One is The Author of Today, A Fair Cry from Kensington by Muriel Spark, which has the main character works in publishing, and she's sort of hounded by this man who she always refers to as a pissier de copy, which not flattering, and his attempts to write things. That's a fun one with traditionally Spark strangeness. Non-fiction one I really loved was called My Salinger Year by Joanna Rakoff. Did you ever read that?
No.
Yeah. So it's when she worked for the literary agency that represents J.D. Salinger, and basically was put in charge of J.D. Salinger's correspondence, essentially, which is replying to everyone saying no, because he's a recluse and says no, or he was alive at the time, you know, recluse and says no to everyone. And I thought that it was a really fascinating insight into a world that it's quite a close book otherwise. And then my third one, she does it a few times, but I'm going to go for According to Mark by Penelope Lively, which is about a biographer. And obviously that's a writer, but you do get a lot in there about the publishing world as well and what is expected from a writer of biography and what the publishers want it to be and what the academic wants it to be. And that clash she does very amusingly. Which I think we did an episode on ages ago. So if you want to hear more about According to Mark, check back in the archives somewhere.
Yeah, very good book, actually. Mine are going to be mainly non-fiction, I think. I really love Diana Rathill's about her time working in the publishing industry. She died a couple of years ago, didn't she?
She did, yeah.
But yeah,
yes. One Stet, isn't it?
Yes. I love reading her insights into things, and she had dealings with many very, very celebrated writers. So really interesting to as an editor. So really interesting to hear her perspective. I really enjoyed Lenny Gooding's A Bite of the Apple. Lenny was one of the founders of the Farrago Press. So she had a lot of interesting stuff to say about founding a feminist press and the politics involved in that. You can't not mention, obviously, 84 Charing Cross Road by Helen Hunt, which is a wonderful book about working in a book. Well, she doesn't work in a bookshop, but the correspondence with someone who does work in a bookshop. I'm struggling to think of anything else. You've mentioned other ones I might have picked up on. I feel like it's something Barbara Pym should write about, but I don't think she actually has.
I can't think of one that.
No.
Were any of the people in Quartet in Autumn working in publishing? Maybe not.
No, I don't think so. But yes, I'm
well,
sure.
Well, that's three. Yeah, that's three. That's plenty for Amanda to be getting on with, I'm sure.
Yes.
But yeah, it is a fun niche, and I will actually just throw one more in, although I don't remember what it's called. Pip Williams wrote a novel about the Oxford English Dictionary. What was that called? Dictionary of Lost Words, I think. Oh. And I used to work for the Oxford English Dictionary or Oxford Dictionaries in their marketing department, and it was very fun to relive that world of the Murrays setting up the dictionary and all that sort of thing. And you know, it's obviously the launch point for a novel, so it's not all true, but it's certainly grounded in truth, and that's fun. So yeah, thanks, Amanda. This is a sort of question you could be asking for episode 150, tlworks@gmail.com. we can give you recommendations for anything you like, and we've mentioned a couple of times already Mira Spark. And we're going to come on to The Bachelors and Symposium. Which would you like to introduce us to?
I don't mind. Whichever one you don't want to do.
Okay. I'll do Symposium then. Do you want to kick off with The Bachelors?
Yes. So, hang on.
Have you read the wrong book?
Yeah, I read The Comforters. I thought that's what we needed.
Oh, no.
I could talk about that.
Well, I have read The Comforters, so let's do that instead. I might be rusty on The Comforters.
That's okay. I will give a very good summary. They're next to each other on the bookshelf, so I must have
so funny.
But I'm glad I read The Comforters because it is actually her first novel, which I didn't know.
It is, yeah.
And it's an interesting one. And it's metafictional, which you kind of work out halfway through. So it's about several people, but it's built around Lawrence, the main character of Lawrence, who is works at the BBC, and he is in a relationship with a woman called Caroline, who has just become a Catholic, and therefore they are no longer allowed to live together, and they have to live apart. And Caroline, soon after this, starts hearing a voice that's narrating the story of her life. And she doesn't understand where this voice is coming from until one day she has this revelation that she's actually a character in a novel, and so is everyone else around her. Within that, there are ridiculous subplots with like smuggling grannies and things like this that are all part of the idea that these people are kind of devices that are being inserted into a novel. So it's an interesting one, quite different to her other books. But yeah, that's the main kind of gist of the plot.
Great. It's dimly coming back to me, so you might do the lion's share on that, because it's been quite a few years since I read it. But The Symposium I have just reread, which is about, I guess the centre of it is a group of people at a dinner party, where one of them is complaining about having recently been burgled. He and his much younger wife were burgled. He starts with him saying it was like rape, and his wife is thinking it wasn't really like rape. And they've stolen a few bits, but they haven't stolen the very, very expensive painting, or very valuable painting, that was on the wall. But then, that's right. Yes. And then we sort of use that as a way of meeting everyone, and then we dart off into their different lives. We've got a couple who aren't married, but who are very devoted to each other, and their sort of slightly strange relationship with each other. We've got another couple who've hired this handsome young man to work alongside them, and he's there as a waiter, and that will be important. We've got I can't remember if they were represented, but we've got backstories of Marxist nuns and a murder plot and someone in an insane asylum who might also be murdering, or like organizing the murder of other people. So it's a short novel. There's an awful lot of very strange things in it, but we all come back to that. We keep coming back to that meal time where we see them all at one point together.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it'd been a very long time since I'd read any Muriel Spark, so I kind of didn't know what to expect. And both of these books are quite different to each other, but they also have at their core that kind of quirky quality that she has in. And also, someone's always Catholic, aren't they?
Yeah.
It's sort of like really bizarre, and I would have loved to have met Muriel Spark to have actually had a conversation with her, because her mind works in very mysterious ways. But if I start with Symposium, which I read after The Comforters, it was interesting actually, because I think Symposium was written in the early 90s, whereas written in the 50s. So you've got a 40-year gap between these novels, but you can completely see the same trademarks of the same writer coming through. So it's that she's maintained this style throughout her entire writing career, which I found really impressive. But I absolutely loved it. And I just thought, I don't understand how you're going to be able to weave all of these threads together. But when I worked out, I was quite pleased with myself, because I worked out that Luke was up to no good, the waiter, before, because I was like, there's got to be a reason why he's there. And I loved how she interconnects all these people. And even though there are quite a few characters, and not all of them are, you know, important in terms of moving the plot forward, but she's so good at, in a couple of paragraphs, just completely creating this entire life for this person, so that you can completely build a picture of what they're like, and their personality comes alive off the page. Like someone like Roland, for example, I mean, he doesn't really have much to do, but you just, that relationship with him and his cousin, and just the way that he's described, it's just like, yeah, I can completely see this person and imagine this dinner party and the kind of conversations that are happening around the table. Then the character of is it is her name Margaret
Muncie, is it? Three, yeah.
Yes. And, you know, this ridiculous backstory where she is a nun in this Marxist convent for 5 minutes, and that idea that she's everywhere she goes, like, people start dying, and it's like, is it her, isn't it? And yeah, it was just brilliant. I loved it. Hilarious.
I'm so glad. Yeah. And it's things like that Margaret story that could have been a full like 300 page novel and stuff that we just get in sort of thrown away backstory. And it's, You do sort of want to work it out, but also it's because it's Spark, it doesn't really matter what the actual truth is. It's just something bizarre that gives you, are they fully rounded characters? They're, in some ways they're caricatures, in some ways they're grotesques, but you also feel like you could meet them. And I think that's what she does so well. She finds like the surreal, even in that first novel, the characters there, I think the main characters are a bit more solid than maybe, but you've got the sort of mad ones in the background, where she clearly, even though it was her first novel, had that confidence to do things that are so unusual and break narrative techniques that are sort of traditionally accepted. And there's one actually in Symposium, one description of a character who's not particularly important really. But it says her general outline was vague and fuzzy, like a shakily taken photograph. And I thought, if you think about it, it doesn't really make sense. Like, how? Of course it isn't, because that doesn't, you know, no one has a fuzzy outline. But it's so good on the impression someone actually makes, and that's what she's got. She's so sharp at these short presentations of people in ways that are surreal, but also tell you about people much more than a psychological realism might do.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, even when the characters are absurd, there's enough about them that that is realistic, or that feels kind of, I suppose, well drawn or recognizable, that you can believe in them even though what you're reading is ridiculous. It's like, seriously? Like, certainly in The Comforters, it's like this woman who, so the Lawrence Manders, who's the main character, his parents are a sir and a lady and they've got a fortune, but his mum's mother is a half gypsy who lives in this like decrepit cottage in the countryside and is at the heart of a diamond smuggling ring. And it's just like, this feels like it shouldn't, like this couldn't possibly exist, but somehow she builds the character so you can totally believe that this would happen.
And she's so good at combining these, like, I always think about The Only Problem, which is a novel about an academic writing about the Book of Job, but then it also gets embroiled in like a terrorist plot. And like, who but Muriel Spark would think to combine those things and do it with, I think it's the confidence she has, that you just sort of go with it, where you're like, okay, sure, that's the world we're in. And yeah, they're all things that could happen, but it's so unlikely. Well, I suppose.
You just have to kind of accept it. And then once you've accepted it, but like, okay, I'm in it now. This is just happening.
And another thing she does in so many novels, and she does it in Symposium, I can't remember if she does it in The Comforters, is disregard narrative time or suspense. So, for example, Symposium, I won't give it away because it is relatively late in the book, but in the final pages, there's a murder in Symposium, but we're told maybe like 30 pages before it happens, who is murdered, why, and by whom, just in a throwaway sentence. And then we just keep going. So there's no suspense for who done it, who's going to die. All of that's gone. But it's somehow, it's so, I don't know why it works, but she's like discarding what are the traditional ingredients of a novel, but not in a sort of annoying, experimental, hard to read way, but in just sort of a like, I've got the authorial control. You're still going to find this novel compelling, even though I'm not playing to the usual rules, but I've done it so well that you're still with me.
Yeah, I mean, she can essentially do what she wants. You do feel a little bit like she's rewriting the rules, and I love that. And it makes the reading experience really exciting, because you don't know what you're going to get, and you have to be prepared to be open-minded and to have your expectations completely trashed. You have to accept bizarre scenarios and believe in people that seem utterly absurd. And I love that you're having to enter into this world that is like, but also not like ours. And it is like being sometimes you meet someone at a party and you end up having like this really weird, trippy conversation. And you're like, wow, you know, I've just had an experience. That's what it felt like when I came out of both of these books.
Yeah. And I think even that, you know, when people talk about The Comforters, the thing they always bring up is that Caroline hears voices in typewriter and then discovers that she is in a novel, which is a wonderful, like a lovely trope. I love it. Not a trope, lovely conceit. And it's really interesting, but it's also not really the main point of the novel. It's not like this big discovery that changes everything. It's just one bizarre thing in a collection of bizarre things that, you know, you can imagine another novel, maybe by some sort of miserable Russian, where that is something that drives the main character mad, and you know, they're obsessed with, or like a Poe story or something. Whereas here, it's just like, yeah, okay, I'm in a novel,
Everyone else in her life is like, oh, okay, yeah, no, that's fine. And that no one makes a big deal of it. It's not a thing. So it's, yeah. And I, again, it's like you are being asked to just accept that. And you don't get an explanation, and there is no actual result of that. It's like, well, the novel just carries on, and these lives are carrying on, and there's not like some big, and so this is significant because, or this causes this to happen. It's like, no, it's just a fact of the life that's being built in this book, and there's no real point to it. Yeah, which is great, isn't it?
It's just wonderful, and I can see maybe why someone would find her annoying. I feel like I'm something much more traditional. And it's interesting, like The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie is obviously her most famous one, and there are, I've seen the Maggie Smith, and there's another, I think, also famous adaptation. And the Maggie Smith one is great, but it is also much more traditional than the experience of reading the novel, I guess, because that one you are constantly unsettled in what's going on to whom and when. And we said it before, it's just she knows all the narrative rules, and she sort of even alludes to them occasionally. She takes the form of traditional novels and just like bashes out the sides and like rearranges things. And they're often really short books as well. So yeah. I think that's partly what makes it work. Symposium is very short. Comfort is also pretty short. And I think because it's just this wild ride that is over quite quickly and packs in much more incident than most long novels, but just tells you them as you sort of rush past, that it works. It's like the sort of bravado that keeps you going.
Yeah. No, she's a brilliant writer. I mean, in fact, when I got back from holiday, I went straight to my shelves and I picked up The Girls of Slender Means, which I'd not read. And I've still got a couple more on my shelf that I've not read. Well, I shall now have to read The Bachelors. So
well, you've got The Bachelors there, which, you know, has amongst its characters like a fake spiritualist, an epileptic handwriting expert. it's so Muriel's fuck. I would say I'm not going to talk about it at length, but if anyone was reading along, I really like The Bachelors. I don't like it as much as I like The Comforters or Symposium, so I don't think it's as high up the list, but it is it's very sparky, and I think it's another quite early one as well.
Yes, I think it is, yeah. So I'm interested to read it. I've got about two or three more on my shelf that I need to get to. So it was very good to be put back in onto her, because I think she's a novelist that I've collected all of her books and then have just never read them for some reason. So
yeah, I did collect all of those beautiful polygon editions, which they've got like little typewriters on the front, and they're beautiful plain hardbacks, but together they really special series they've done for her centenary or something, I think.
My copy of Symposium, actually, I realised when I opened it, I was like, oh, Simon gave me this because it's got your name in it.
Oh, did I? Yeah. That's, yeah, because I had all her books and then I was like, I have to get all the polygon ones. So I was just like liberally giving them away to people.
My sister's got it now. She's very much enjoying it. So.
And Karen from Cagsey's Bookish Ramblings originally gave it to me. So there you go. It's being passed around any number of people. Yeah. And I don't know much about anything about, I want to say, Plato, Aristotle, who did Symposium, but like I feel if I knew my Latin history more, or my Greek history, gosh, I'm totally at sea. But I feel like it's an homage to something. Is it?
I don't know. I've got no idea. I mean, I did do Latin at school, but I didn't make that connection. I was on holiday, my brain was switched off. That's my excuse.
There we go. Plato. It does quote Plato's Symposium. In fact, yes, the little, what's the word I want? Epigraph. Is the chief thing which he remembered was Socrates compelling the other two to acknowledge that the genius of comedy was the same with that of tragedy, and that the true artist in tragedy was an artist in comedy also. Interesting. Not sure what to do with that.
So it is a tragedy because someone dies at the end, but there's comedy within it.
Yes, I don't think anyone reading it would find it tragic. It's definitely funnier than it is tragic. But the people in it are living tragedies much of the time. Yeah. We're just enjoying them.
Yes.
And in fact, I particularly liked that age gap couple are in, that we get some letters from the wife who is clearly writing, not enamored with her husband.
Yes, writing to his daughter about how miserable she is.
Yes, who's also like her school friend. So, yeah, that's funny. I just think it's amazing that she started out a career so. Well, I think she'd written a couple of biographies before this, but her first novel, Comforters, so strange, continued to be strange right through to the end. And it's in some ways it's sad that she's basically known, I say broadly, for the Prime Minister Brady, which is great, but there's so much more to her and so many more. Well, and that's a weird book as well, actually. But yeah, there's so many weird things in her books. And if you're looking for her, have your expectations totally uprooted, then you can't go wrong.
No. Yeah. Most enjoyable.
Which of the two are you going to choose?
I think I mean, I really enjoyed both of them, but I think the Symposium just picked Comforters to the Post for me because it was so well written and so funny consistently.
Yeah, Symposium is one of my very favourites of hers, so I was glad to revisit it. I think it's got a lot of things that make Spark, you know, a lot of things you'll recognise from other books in a good way. And I often recommend it to people as their first one if they've not read her before, because I think it really gives you a sense of who she is.
Yeah.
There you go.
Read them.
Yeah, and 149 episodes in, we're still not necessarily reading the same book as each other. Oh dear.
What are we like? Well, what am I like, really?
Yeah, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I misremember the title I suggested at the end of last. Well, we don't know. And I think we've definitely read at least Prime Minister Brady. I can't remember if we have read other Sparks, but people can go and find out more about other Sparks in our back catalogue, I'm sure. And I think
it's Far Cry from Kensington.
Oh, did we? Maybe we compared the two together. Yeah. And in fact, The Bachelors was my final Spark novel, so I've now read them all.
Oh, well done.
A long time. Yeah.
So what's the best out of all of hers then, in your opinion?
My absolute favourite is Loitering with Intent, which I've only actually read once, so I hope I'd love it again. But that's sort of actually in the book world, to go back to Amanda's question. It's about this woman who becomes like the secretary of the autobiography club. Or I'm not sure it's called that, but these different people writing their autobiographies, but she starts just making them up. It turns out what she's making up is also what happened to them. So yeah, strange. That's definitely, one of my favorite books and my favorite Spark. And indeed, if people Google unnecessary rankings, Muriel Spark stuck in a book, something along those lines, you can find I've ranked all the books I'd read by her. maybe I need to slot in the final two that I've read since I wrote that. But if you'd like us to rank any more authors for you, et cetera, do send those questions in to teaorbooks@gmail.com. And we look forward to answering them in episode 150. And if you live in or near London and want to come to Rachel's play, if you want to let us know that you're going to be there, do get in touch at teaorbooks@gmail.com as well. That'd be lovely.
It'd be lovely to see you. All right. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Bye.